Support for State Week comes from the following sponsors: PI.org, the Illinois Education Association, and Visit Springfield.
From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the state representative Harry Benton resigned from the legislature last month amid allegations of sexual harassment, but the fallout continues, and a lot of that heat is coming down on the House Speaker Chris Welch. Some have even called for him to resign. We'll get the latest. And when it comes to the Democratic Party across the country, there is a divide, even in the Midwest. Can the party come together? We'll talk more about it, all coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is the Chicago Tribune's chief political writer, Rick Pearson. Rick, thanks for being with us once again.
Thank you, Sean.
Rick, you were here with us just a couple of weeks ago. People might remember that, but we wanted to have you back to discuss more of what's happening with this controversy that has engulfed the Speaker's office. And you've been all over this story, and since we last spoke, an Inspector General's report was released. So let me go back to that. Did we learn anything new from that report?
Not really. And I think even in our reporting pre the release of this report, I sought to lower the temperature of what was going to come out of it because of what the Inspector General could legally look at and review versus what he really couldn't. Benton resigned July 3rd. The Inspector General's report was done July 1st. Speaker Welch called for him to resign or face expulsion on July 2nd. Benton resigns the 3rd. And subsequently withdraws from re-election for the general election. The report itself comes out on, is made public on the 31st of July, and basically contained a synopsis of many of the things that I and my colleague Jeremy Gorner wrote in our investigation of what was going on with Benton on July 17th, that basically, as we reported then, that Speaker Welch knew of Harry Benton's harassment conduct 3 years before he took these latest steps to remove him from the Democratic caucus and subsequently ask for the Inspector General investigation and force his resignation. And there's very little detail here about what the Speaker did. And that is the fundamental question and why there's still this continued fallout. Is what did the Speaker do? Why didn't he do more? If he had acted in 2023 when a former Benton staffer had sent his office a lengthy list of harassment complaints that ultimately forced her to quit her job after only 6 months, she never heard of any disciplinary action taken against Benton. If the Speaker had acted in 2023, would two women have faced harassment, which ultimately led to the Speaker's actions? Why 3 years?
Since all of this came out, since this report was released, Welch has followed, I guess, what I'd call a PR 101. He's done some interviews with media outlets. He's pretty much given, I guess you would call it, an apology, and also launched a working group to look at the policies in such cases, or says he's going to launch this working group. Is that doing enough, though, to quell those who have been critics of him?
No, it's not. And in fact, the Speaker somehow still maintains that the Inspector General's report vindicates the actions that he took, where there is no— the Inspector General's office did not make any judgment on what the Speaker did or didn't do. And the Speaker maintains, and as you pointed out, he's been doing just very recently these media outreach kind of things. Not to the Tribune, of course, which we've been asking ever since, even before we published on July 17th to interview the Speaker. We still haven't heard from him personally, and I don't expect to hear from him either. But that's okay. Why talk to the only outlet that actually talked to the victims of harassment? Mm-hmm. So Welch has been able to present kind of a one-sided story to my colleagues in the media who aren't as familiar with what the story is and what the victims say and do. Welch has maintained, one, that he was hamstrung by the Benton staffer's decision not to file a report with the inspector general. And so that limited any discipline he could do because Benton was entitled to due process. Well, we know from the fact that the speaker has disciplined members without concerns of due process. We saw he got mad at Fred Crespo for working on an alternative budget, excommunicated him from the Democratic caucus. We saw he was angry over some purported statements by Mary Flowers, excommunicated her from the caucus. Why didn't he take any kind of steps to put Harry Benton into time out? The speaker says he conducted an internal investigation, which, as far as we can tell, consisted of taking the statements from the Benton staffer and talking to Harry Benton. He concluded that after Benton vehemently denied anything, that this was a he said, she said, and he couldn't do anything more. We have also learned that the speaker, in reaching out to his various Democratic caucuses, he told the House Democratic Women's Caucus that one of the reasons that he gave Harry Benton $1.4 million for his reelection campaign the year after this Benton staffer had complained, one of the reasons he did it was because Benton, an iron worker, union member, that the speaker feared that he would lose union support and fundraising support. So what does that say about, you know, putting the politics and fundraising of the speaker's office ahead of the harassment of this Benton staffer, as well as letting him get reelected only to engage in harassment again and again?
We'll be back with more on State Week in just a moment.
Support for State Week comes from PIORG, a nonprofit consulting firm providing resources for strategic planning, best practice implementation, and outcomes-focused program evaluation across the country, helping organizations make data understandable and actionable, enabling change makers to strengthen critical skills and serve others more effectively. PI, Plan, Implement, Evaluate. Services and information at PIORG.org.
We're back on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune and Charlie Wheeler. And Charlie, you've been listening to what Rick had to say and some of the background of this story. What do you make of this from what you've been reading about?
To put it very simply, I think Welch handled things very poorly. I think his explanations for why he did what he did don't hold any water at all. As Rick pointed out, he basically excommunicated other members for what, in my judgment, were offenses much less objectionable or much less serious than what Benton is credibly accused of doing. And this notion, for example, that I think you had it in your story a couple of days ago, he did it because he was afraid that he was going to lose union support. That, to me, doesn't hold water. Where are the unions going to go? Are they going to go to the Republicans? Give me a break. Are they going to withhold some money from Welch from his campaign activities? That's not a big deal in my judgment, considering the overwhelming support that the Democrats have in this state, in part because of the maps they drew, and the fact that Welch, I think, would have looked much better had he just cut Benton loose and said, look, this is very offensive to me, to my membership, and with your kind of background and your track record, you don't belong in our caucus. And so I'm not going to support you for re-election. And he didn't do any of those things. As a matter of fact, there was a story in one of the local papers that went to great lengths to background how Welch himself had problems in this area during his time in Proviso Township and in local offices. And so, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, Fred Crespo, as you mentioned earlier, he has already said that Welch should resign and he will not support him for speaker. And one of the, I would say, most vocal of the women supporters, Representative Kelly Cassidy, has also suggested that we need a new speaker. And it was interesting because one of the things Welch said he was going to do is he's going to set up this working group to study what could be done, what kind of changes we can make in our procedures. And he did not name the people. And one of his allies, one of his political aides, did some name dropping, including Cassidy's name as being on the task force. And Cassidy reacted very, what would you say, I guess hostily would be the same. And she said, she issued a statement saying that she was not going to participate in this working group. And her quote, "Prior to agreeing to serve on the working group, I asked a series of questions in order to ensure that the group would offer more than lip service or a PAR stunt. My questions were not answered. And her name," she said, "was leaked as part of this process without my agreement. I'm disappointed, as I believe a working group on this topic would be necessary and important. But we have a responsibility to victims and survivors to ensure any such body is credible and effective. And I currently do not have confidence that it will be."
Rick, the speaker has said, you know, maybe the policies need a review, all of that. But policies were put in place before, after something similar occurred under the former House Speaker Michael Madigan. So is it a case, do you think, from what you've read, of the policies just were not sufficient? Or do you think that it just was they weren't followed sufficiently?
I would say that I don't think they were followed sufficiently. I mean, the speaker is trying to split hairs here by saying that district staff workers, of which this Benton staffer was, that their employer is the state representative. They're not the House of Representatives. They're paid by the House of Representatives. And when the staffer wanted to report the harassment she was facing, she was given a list of reportable entities for reporting sexual harassment in the General Assembly, in the House of Representatives. And one of those was the chief of staff to the Speaker of the House. And that's where she went. That's where the staffer went and gave this lengthy list of allegations, all of which, as many as we could, we've vetted and found credible.
So I guess the bottom line with this, Rick, a lot of people are looking at this and wondering, maybe Welch, unless he resigns, you know, probably nothing's going to happen right now, and he could resign. We don't know that. But, I mean, let's say he doesn't. He still faces his caucus. This would be after the election. Most likely Democrats will at least hang on to control of the Illinois House. So his caucus will then vote on who should be the speaker going forward. Is he in some trouble there? Do you see that?
Well, I do see that he believes he's in trouble when you look at the fact that, you know, as this was unfolding, he went to the Chicago Teachers Union and pledged how he would lead the effort to come up with more state funding for the Chicago Public Schools, which are facing a massive deficit and layoffs and cuts. But he's saying, you know, I'm going to have a plan, which he doesn't have a plan. And he's now even backtracking on that somewhat and saying, oh, I was just talking about money for all schools. Well, this is kind of the floundering around that really shows that I think he's in trouble. One of the things, too, and this has kind of been alluded to, is sure, Democrats are certainly likely to maintain their supermajority. But it for a member now going into the election is highly unlikely to be overtly critical of Welch when they're dependent on campaign money from him for their election. That having been said, it's still, I think, a somewhat of a litmus question to ask Democratic candidates, will you support Speaker Welch for re-election as Speaker? I think that's one. And two, after the election, you know, we're kind of in an open season then. The members aren't as dependent on Welch for, I mean, they're going to hold office. And that lessens some of that pressure to be critical or to vote against him.
And Charlie, that's always a risk, a gamble, I think, if you challenge somebody that way. especially somebody who has shown himself, as we mentioned earlier, to basically hold a grudge against some lawmakers for doing so. You could find yourself really on the outs and no committee assignments, or at least no committee chairmanships, things like that. Do you expect that Welch could face some pushback here?
Oh, I think he will. And the question is, how overt will it be? I'm sure that there are women legislators other than Cassidy who are saying, we don't want him to be our speaker. We just don't trust him. And I'm sure they're talking among themselves and trying to round up support. And as you say, after the election, when they no longer need to worry about his money, then the question is, will they be able to bring him down? That's what happened basically to Mike Madigan. A number of the women legislators told him, we're not going to vote for you for speaker. And Madigan counted noses, and he realized that he didn't have what he needed. And he agreed to withdraw, and he basically anointed Welch to be his successor. And as a matter of fact, one of the people who was instrumental in bringing down Madigan was a campaign staffer named Elena Hampton. And she had an op-ed in the Trib a couple of days ago saying that Madigan's departure, quote, was thought to have marked the end of an era, but electing new leadership without changing the culture allows the same system to persist under a different name. She goes on to say, the most troubling part of the Benton situation is not only what allegedly happened in that office, it is that Welch's office knew about those allegations years before Benton's resignation and implemented zero consequences that could have protected future victims. Even worse, Welch and his organization then worked to re-elect Benton and kept the allegations a secret. This is not a one-off breach in judgment. It's a long-standing pattern. If he can't even recognize that he's handled something wrong, how can we trust him to strengthen existing workplace protections and implement new ones? The answer is, we can't. So what Hampton is saying is, we went through this before with Madigan, and Madigan basically counted noses, saw the future, and decided to withdraw as speaker.
You're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week comes from Visit Springfield, featuring dozens of attractions and overnights on Route 66 in the capital city. Springfield is home to numerous Lincoln sites, Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House, the Illinois State Capitol, and more. The Visit Springfield team can help organizers plan their event in the capital city. Attractions and tourism information at visitspringfieldillinois.com.
And you're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Well, in the time we have left, let's turn our attention to elections. And a big race is going to be happening in Chicago, but it's not until next year, although it's getting underway now. Alexi Janulis has announced he's in the race for Chicago mayor. It's a crowded field already. Janulis is the Secretary of State, and he's seeking re-election for that position. The mayoral election is early next year. Rick, is he the front runner now that he's announced?
I think it's fair to say that, but I would say early front runner because this field is still very much unsettled. I would say front runner based on the fact that he has $22 million in the bank. But that having been said, this is going to be, and truly it's always interesting, you know, being in Chicago, because for the most part, everybody in the city has moved past the November election, and they're already focused on next spring and the mayoral. You know, it's a matter of seeing how this field develops, how various candidates pick their lane. Mayor Brandon Johnson, who of course is not viewed very favorably in public opinion polls, he has not even formally announced whether he's running again. You always have a kind of a racial component into elections as to kind of the breakdown of the city and how do votes kind of get squashed by another candidate. Willie Wilson, who is like a perennial candidate, always gets about 10%, very popular in the black community. How much does that hurt a Brandon Johnson re-election effort. So there's all kinds of variables here, but certainly the fact that Giannoulis is a known quantity. I mean, he's been on TV running ads ostensibly for his re-election as Secretary of State, but which are basically veiled ads for Chicago mayor. And it's interesting too to see him really kind of strike a more progressive tone in these ads and in his mayoral race, which hasn't always really been kind of his traditional lane. So all of these candidates are going to be trying to find which lane are they in.
And Charlie, Secretary of State, this used to be a position that could really launch somebody's political career to much higher office. And we have seen that governors, you know, others have moved from that position. Now, that being said, Jesse White's was in the role so long, and he wasn't running for anything above that position. So I think maybe it lost its luster a little bit when it comes to that. But Giannoulis could change that, it seems to me. I mean, this is a guy he's on your driver's licenses. You get things from him all the time. A lot of, I would almost call it feel-good legislation that gets passed. Important, but still, you know, not that controversial sometimes. Like legislation that was signed this week to allow the state to review insurance rates. You know, so that's very pro-consumer. And it looks to me like Giannoulis is set up pretty well here. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, as Rick said, it's still a long way before the election for mayor, but he's got a tremendous advantage in money, which will allow him to do a couple of things. One is he'll be able to challenge when the petitions are actually filed. He'll be able to challenge the signatures on some of the other folks, and my guess is some of them won't clear the bar. He'll also be able to provide kind of under the table support for some of the other black candidates, Willie Wilson, for example, who might draw support away from Mayor Johnson if he decides to run again, which it's still an open question, I think. But the thing that the kind of the factoid that really I found telling is that in the last reporting period for campaign funding, Giannoulis reported earning more interest on his war chest than any other of the declared candidates took in actual contributions in that same period. So he's sitting on this pot of money. He has a lot of things he can do with it. I think it's an uphill climb for anybody else to match it. Now, some of the people obviously have great name recognition, Susana Mendoza, Congressman Mike Quigley, but still it's going to be a battle, I think.
Well, just a couple of minutes left, and Rick, since we have you on the show, somebody who follows politics, not just in Illinois, but across the country, I thought we'd ask you about this. Earlier this week, a big Michigan Democratic Senate primary result. It followed the script of what we've seen in some other states. Progressives, they're very excited about Abdul El-Sayed winning there. They say it shows the party's become more progressive, even here in the Midwest. And this seems to be a real key fight for where the Democratic Party is headed. What do you make of that result and also just looking ahead? I mean, just a couple of years away from the next national election for president, the Democratic Party, are they going more left?
Well, I think that's very much evident in some of these victories. And although the El-Sayed victory was much closer than what had been expected. And so to me, that shows that when you have a swing state like Michigan, the Democrats are as divided as ever, reflecting kind of the national sentiment. We're going to be looking at a similar election coming up in Wisconsin in the Democratic primary there for governor. All of these things are just showing this kind of leftward drift. There was a recent CNN poll that found that among Democrats, one third of them consider themselves Democratic Socialists, which is a phenomenal number and also just so reflective of this leftward movement. And what does that foretell for the Democratic Party, which Charlie and I have joked over the years that, you know, the Democrats hold a firing squad in a circle. And this is, you know, what is going to be the future of this party, and what does it say about, here again, the parties going Democrats to the left, Republicans to the right, the vast center feeling unrepresented? You know, where do those people turn?
And time now for our notes from the field, and Rick, we'll stay with you.
Found it interesting that, you know, as there's talk of how Republicans are facing headwinds in their races for Congress, partially because of the economy and dislike for Trump and those kinds of things, the Cook Political Report, out of all of the congressional races, congressional elections in the country for November 3rd, only 37 districts were deemed competitive. 18 are toss-ups, 10 lean Democrat, and 9 lean Republican. Now, they go on to say that if Democrats won all of the most competitive districts, they would win 235 seats. But that was under the 2024 map. And remember, Republicans moved to redistrict some seats mid-decade. Democrats tried to counter. Under the current map, if Democrats won those competitive districts, they would only win 223 seats. Still a majority, but a very narrow one.
And Charlie?
The Illinois Flash Index for July dipped down to 101.2 from a June level of 101.4, a small decline which reflects the index's stability over the last year, according to Professor Emeritus Fred Geertz, who compiles the index for the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. The economy is still growing, the professor reported, although more slowly than in the recovery period after COVID. His quote is, "The stability of both the national and Illinois economies remains astonishing amidst relentless political and economic chaos worldwide," Gertz said. But he warned that the recent Federal Reserve decision to keep rates unchanged signals growing uncertainty. And on the more official state level, revenues into the state's general funds began on a positive note in the first month of the fiscal year. July of this year, of course, was the first month of fiscal 2027. And this is a report from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. Receipts increased by $188 million compared to last July, driven primarily by sizable gains in corporate income tax sales, in corporate income tax and in sales tax receipts, which more than offset declines among several other state revenue sources. So that is off to a promising start for the new year.
Well, we're out of time for State Week. Our panel this week included Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus, and also Rick Pearson, the Chief Political Writer for the Chicago Tribune. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Support for State Week comes from the members of the Illinois Education Association, serving 135,000 members of educators and support professionals around Illinois. IEA's mission is to promote excellence and equity in public education. When schools and communities unite, we all win. Resources and membership information at ieanea.org.